At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Wow, here we are. Again. So I had an improv show last night.
How'd it go?
Oh, I don't think it went well at all.
You say that every time. Why do you keep doing it?
Because it's practice. You got to get some, you know, I don't think it went well. Here's the thing. I played, the premise was Truth. The title of the show, because it was a series finale. The title of the show was, was The Truth With or Without It. And for some reason, it was God was on trial, and I played the role of God. So I played God last night.
That's a lot of pressure.
It was a lot of pressure. And here's the thing is I approached God, you know, in improv, you go top of brain, right? Top of the dome. I was like, oh, I'm benevolent. I really felt God was good in my world, which I'm going to be honest, wasn't as fun.
Yeah.
I think God should have been a little piece of shit. I think like God, like just because
I think
here's
the good news. I think God is bad at improv.
Because God can sort of create anything. So it's like,
we see a lot of improv, right? Like out on the streets, you're like, that was an improvisation gone wrong.
That was an improv gone wrong. Most conversations of mine are improv gone wrong, to be honest, to be fair. And then I went to a party beforehand, and then I did softball before that. It was a busy day for me. My feet, the dogs, woof, woof, they're barking. How was your day yesterday? You sent me the cutest picture ever, though, yesterday.
Oh, did I? Which one? Mm-hmm. Oh, of co-teaching Griff.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That is so cute.
So was that Tuesday or was that yesterday?
That was yesterday.
Okay, how did it go? What's the TLDR?
He had a blast. He was so happy. He came home feeling really good about it. I said, so did you teach them? He's like, yeah, I read them a book. I helped them. I went to like recess with them. It was very sweet. He had a really, really good time.
And how was Griffin's experience?
Good as well. Less interested in talking to me about it, I would say.
he's four.
Yeah. But Koa could really explain that he had a lovely time. Then we had some people over for dinner, and I made like a really big fish taco buffet.
Did you do with the flounder?
I did so many things with the flounder. I did half of it. I did like a dip in a flour and egg and fry it for the tacos.
Wait, the dip with the flour flounder? I did the same thing, and then I did like a garlic butter sort of thing. Delicious.
Yeah, and then I did ceviche.
You had two servings.
A full share, so we have a lot of fish.
And the flounder felt like it was a lot. Am I wrong in that?
No, I felt like it was a little. I think it's because they're so thin.
I got like 5 pieces.
Yeah, me too. But I still was like, I could use more.
That's fair. How was the ceviche?
The ceviche was delicious.
They said it was sushi grade. So before I cooked it, I cut a piece off and dipped it in soy sauce. And I was like, this feels like too much.
Yeah. Ceviche was good.
You need the acid.
You need the acid. And it's like, you need like an artful knife skill maybe. Like it does just feel like it's a kind of fish that they say you can eat raw. But I did just feel like I was eating a raw fish in a way that.
It didn't feel good when I popped it in my mouth. And you can quote me on that. Is like I put the raw. I was like, it says it's sushi grade. I have this fish. I'm cooking it the night of.
Kind of
spongy?
Like
I should take it. It was like, you know what it felt like? It felt like if I was watching, you know, when you watch people eat like meat, like I just felt very carnal. It felt like I was on the carnivore diet, and I have zero interest in joining
that team.
You
felt like you were on a desert island, and you were, like, flexing.
It felt like I was, like, I should have had Wilson next to me, and I should have been, my hair, I should have been really tan, and I was in the cast of Castaway, but it's a small cast. It was me and this flounder. And, yeah, it just felt like I was on Survivor. And I didn't, and I was like, if I'm eating sushi, I don't want to feel like I'm on Survivor. That feels weird.
No, or at least give me a challenge while I eat it. Like, make me build a pyramid.
I don't want a challenge.
Like,
I'll be honest.
Blocks.
So yesterday during softball, it was really stressful. We were like up by a lot, and then it was the last play, and I was playing catcher, and the bases were loaded because our pitcher had three people walk. And so everybody beforehand, Quinn, it was fucking terrifying. Everyone beforehand was like, Carrie, it's coming to you. Are you ready to catch it? And I was like, I couldn't. And I'm with like all these like aggro theater boys. And yeah. I'm like, no, yeah. And it was so stressful. And so I'm, the guy hits the ball. It goes to first base. He, like, my friend throws it to me while he's falling. And I, like, barely catch it, and I step on the plate, and it, like, sort of pops out of my mitt. They call the runner in. We lose the game. And I felt so fucking bad, and my friends were like, it's not your fault. Like, it's actually not your fault. Like, it was not a good throw. And you were like, you know, there was a lot of things. But, like, let me tell you, I have never felt like a sore. I wasn't a sore loser. I was an embarrassed loser yesterday. And the nice thing is the manager of the team reached out and was like, that, Carrie, you caught. Because it was in my glove. And I think it was, like, on the floor. So it wasn't the strong. It was not good. Mm-hmm. No one blamed me. I blamed me. It did not feel good. I don't like pressure in sports. That's here's the thing. I love to play sports when the vibes are good. When the pressure is on me, I fucking choke. I am not good under pressure. And, you know, it was just tough. The bases were loaded. They're like, Carrie, it's coming to you. Quinn, it was really hard.
Sounds fucking stressful. I would not have had a good time.
It was not a good ending to that. The nice thing is that I got a shout out in the newsletter that was like, you had him out, which I was like, okay, I don't think I did. But I love that that's the energy. That being said,
How often do you guys play?
Every week, Thursdays, 2:15. Nice. It is, come, Central Park, 2:15 on Thursdays. It is, but I'm really my arm is really tired. Mm-hmm. And when you play catcher, it's a lot of grand plies.
Oh, sure.
You know, you're really squatting.
Ooh, so yesterday was hot as hell.
Yesterday was fucking hot, too.
Gross. I have heat rash in my elbows and knee creases.
Oh, wow. Quinn, that's not good.
I think I blocked some of my sweat ducts with that tanning foam. vanity.
Well, you look great.
Thank you.
Me, I have no. Sick. Can you tell I have no self tanner on? You look at me and it's like, is she blending into the background of her apartment?
Of her white apartment.
Yes. Of my white apartment. I am trying to put in my air conditioners, and I don't know what I'm doing, and it's really tough.
That's really tough. Matt's friend Natalie was here last night, and she was like, what does anyone know about putting in an air conditioner? And Matt's like, I'm great at it. Let me give you why that was an annoying thing for him to say. When I got up to go to work yesterday, we were like, it's going to be 90. And I was like, what do you got going on today? And he's like, very little, very little. Going to do laundry, going to put in the ACs. And I was like, great. Got home 6.5 hours later. And he was
what
like,
happened?
So sorry, I didn't get those ACs in. I was like, what? And then we had people over, no AC in. And then during the dinner, Matt went upstairs to put the ACs in because we had to have ACs in for bedtime
because
the kids would not have slept. But they're in now. It's all a happy ending. And the happiest part is that I stayed patient and I didn't tantrum about it. I had my last therapy session last Monday, so I'm really I'm on my own now, and I have to really...
Oh, no. Oh, no.
I have to stay strong and kind. I have to stay strong and kind. Not my strong suit, kindness. So, we got a new Patreon.
We do!
Huleya? All right, J-U-L-L-E-A. How would you say? Huleya, right?
Hold on, wait. J-U-L-L-E-A pronounce... J-U-L-L-E-A?
Uh-huh. Julia? Huleya?
Huleya.
Huleya?
Huleya. I don't know. I'm looking at pronounce name.com.
Apologies in advance, Huleya.
No, it's Julia.
Julia?
Okay, I'm looking at Ask Oracle.
Well, here's the thing. Does it change anything for you that the last name is Ramos?
Ramos?
It makes me think it would be an H pronunciation on the J. But I'm no etymologist.
You know what? We're going to do two songs. Huleya, Huleya, you're such a slayer of the good times. That doesn't mean you slay bad times. It means you have good times. Huleya, Huleya, let's go to a hula. You are so fun. Thank you for coming
very
here.
Very coola.
And then we have Julia, Julia, is that your name? Which one is correct? I don't know, but we want to cover both bases because you are so generous. We love your face, although we've never seen it in real life.
All right.
Quinn has a cold. Are you okay?
I have a cold, you guys. I have a cold.
As soon as I said you have a cold, you started sniffing.
Well, my nose started running.
That is
like almost like you said that, and my nose heard you. Yeah.
That was.
No, I started to feel a little bit sick last night, and then I woke up today and was like, oh, bother. I do not want to get out of bed.
I'm going to tell a story, but let's maybe pause in case we have sponsors.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
God, I hope that wasn't a crazy person reading that ad. I really hope. I'm still triggered by it. Okay. I got this information from a Medium article, Oxygen, the LA Times. I want to take you back to 2001, and I want to introduce you to Megan Barroso. We're in California, and Megan loves fashion. She loves fun. She's a great friend. And she's 20 years old, and it's 4th of July weekend. And she's celebrating the long weekend. She's having a party. She's going out with her friends, Lindsay. So the first stop of the night is Lindsay's family is having a party at their home. And so she goes to her friend's house, and it's pretty cute. Her friend Lindsay has this bottle of red glitter, and it's a festive occasion, right? If you can't wear glitter on 4th of July, when can you wear glitter? I know, New Year's. But if like you get like two
times
a year. I
know the answer. New Year's. I'll answer
There's like two times a year I think you can rock glitter. I think it's at Thanksgiving and or I think it's at
you're like Flag Day for sure.
Arbor Day for sure. It's kind of Arbor Day feels
and
like
Martin Luther King
and
Day.
And Martin Luther King Jr.
We
Day.
All know that's all know a glitter day.
Those are the glitter days. Honestly, wearing glitter during Arbor Day feels hurtful because of all the microplastics in it. So anyway, so you have 4th of July because you want to match the beautiful sky of fireworks. And you have New Year's because you're
you
getting
also
older,
want to match
time
the
is passing.
Sky of fireworks.
And you feel like time is fleeting and joy is dead because you're celebrating. You're celebrating the last holiday of that season. And then it is wintry hell. And so you need one last peak of joy, and that's glitter. So anyway, so it's 4th of July weekend. Her friend has this red bottle of glitter. She pours it on her friend. Ah, having a good time. The two are loving life. After the barbecue at Lindsay's house, they go over to watch the fireworks at Silver Strand Beach with some friends from their high school. And then at 10:30 at that night, they're like, let's keep the party going. So they go over to a friend's apartment in Newberry Park, California, and they're hanging out until the wee hours of the morning. It is 2:45 in the morning. And Megan's like, I got to get out of here. She has a rental car. She hugs her friend. She kisses her goodbye. And she heads home. While she was at the party, they were like, you should just stay over. It's late enough. You should just spend the night. And she's like, no. And frankly, I get it. If my bed is within driving distance, I'm going home. I need to sleep in my bed. Mm-hmm. So she leaves. And then it's July 5th the next day. And nobody's heard from Megan. And police stumble upon a car that is in the center median near a highway underpass, and the car is still running, and it is empty. It is Megan's car.
We're still running.
It's still running. The car is not in good shape. One of the first things they notice is there are 5 bullet holes in the windshield. Most of them are in the windshield. They find blood on the seat. They find blood on the steering wheel. They find Megan's purse. They find her phone. And they find one of her sandals still in the car. Mm. Like I said, Megan is not there. The hunt for Megan is on. So they're following any lead. They're asking, did she leave in a hurry? Or was she abducted from the car? Seeing blood, seeing bullet holes is not a good sign. But they are looking for Megan high and low. In the rental car, they have a little black box, which shows sort of the movements of the car. So they're able to go what happened in the moments before the car was abandoned, which they see Megan getting off the ramp or off the highway. And then they see her gunning it, like hitting the pedal to the metal 100% quickly. And then the car seems to lose control. And that's when it ends up on the median where it is found. Mm-hmm. So it seems like if they're piecing this together, the right assumption is that something freaked her out and she tried to scram, get away as quickly as possible. And that's where the car ended up. And so at this point, they're searching high and low. What I didn't mention is that in this area, there is also a serial rapist on the loose known as the Simi Valley Rapist. These attacks plagued this community for 5 years. It started in 1996. And we know that the person who is committing these acts of violence would typically stalk their victims before. They were obsessed with keeping themselves completely covered up, protecting their identity. They would wear a ski mask. They often would know their victim's name. They also would know their victim's family's names. So they would, when they would attack their victims, they would often use their family members as a direct threat, right? Like, do you want me to kill your grandmother? The MO of this assailant was spoiler alert, it's a man. He would break into the victim's homes in the middle of the night. Sometimes he would take off the window screens, or he would slide in through glass doors. Like I said, his identity was his most important attribute. In fact, all of his victims commented on they didn't see his face, and he was very, very, very aware of keeping it covered. Mm-hmm. Not all of his attacks ended in an assault. There were a lot of victims that fortunately were able to fight him off, or victims who were not alone in the home and they screamed. And when someone came, he would often take off running. But there were plenty of victims of him. I think there were over 15 victims during these 5 years where he would take them out of the home and he would take them to his home, all while keeping a sweatshirt or something covering their face. He would take videos of them. He would take photos of them. He would steal trophies from all of his victims. One woman recalls waking up at 4 a.m. and to a noise, and she recalls seeing a knife blade through her door jamb, poking through, working on the hook and eye lock. So if you have that lock over your door, imagine waking up and there's a knife trying to...
That is terrifying.
It's fucking terrifying. She sees this happening. She grabs the phone. She tries to call 911. A man in a ski mask comes out, covers her mouth, holds a knife to her throat. He marches her crouching to a hallway window where he tries to pull her through it to take her with him. But she screams and her mom comes and fights him off and he flees the scene. Another woman recalls putting up a fight and she had taken self-defense classes and she had taken her feet and she just jammed him across the chest and he fled from there. One woman was tackled while she was walking in her hallway in her home. She kicked him. She bites his finger and he starts to beat her up. He takes an empty beer bottle and he hits her across the face until she passes out. She comes to. She sees a nearby wooden family photo frame. She hits him as hard as she could. The photo shatters. He stumbles and she grabs hold of a metal lamp ready to strike again. And he says, "Okay, okay, you win. I just have to find my mask," because she couldn't see him. Mm-hmm. It was dark. So he, like, again, made sure that the mask was on and he fled. Mm-hmm. Another woman recalls, like, him on top of her and her just going under his mask and trying to claw to get DNA. The most recent attack at this point is July 9th, 2001, which again is 4 days after Megan disappeared. But there was another kidnapping and rape of a woman. But like I said, there's still no sign of Megan, and the police are just trying to reconstruct the night of her disappearance. And they're not putting the two and two together just yet because, again, we have a serial rapist and no one has been killed at this point. So they're saying it's probably not the MO. So they don't know what's happening. So they're collecting alibis from all the people that she was at the party with. And they even make a comment about how they get the alibi of a guy who was unsuccessfully flirting with her. And again, everybody has an mm-hmm. alibi. There's no leads. They don't know what's going on. Then it is July 26th. 22 days after Megan goes missing, and the police catch a lead. The police get wind about a burglary perpetrated by a guy called Vincent Sanchez, and he is stealing from his neighbor. Now, Sanchez is a 31-year-old out-of-work carpenter. He had gotten injured on the job. He was out of work. And while he's arrested, he calls his roommate and he asks him, "Hey, I have a bag near a dumpster by the apartment building. Can you make sure you throw it out?" His roommate goes to take a look at the bag, and he's nosy Nelly, and he starts going through it. And in it, he sees underwear, he sees jewelry, which we know now are trophies from his mm-hmm. victims. He sees videos, he sees photos of women in, obviously, a compromising position. And he's like, "This is not good. I'm weirded out by this." The roommate calls the police, and the police go in, they take a look, and they see that these photos and stuff match the victims of the Simi Valley rapist. Mm-hmm. They also see all these trophies also match the victims. Mm-hmm. Again, this has been going on since 1996. So when we dive deeper into Vincent Sanchez's backstory, here's a little bit about him. He's one of 8 children. He comes from loving but strict parents. That's all that's said about it. Mm-hmm. He's dropped out of high school and he has had a series of run-ins with the law. When he left high school, he started dating a 17-year-old girl who was a single mother who had a child from another person. The two of them were together, and in 1992, they bring the child into the hospital, and the child is having a hard time breathing. This will inevitably lead to a child abuse case levied against Vincent, and he spends 2 years in prison. Mm-hmm. He gets out, and then he starts seeing another woman who's 10 years older than him, and she has 4 kids. She describes the relationship as toxic. He is possessive. He's a peeping Tom. She's caught him looking into her windows around this time. This is around 1995. It's soon after this.
But this is a person she's in a relationship with.
Yes.
That spies on her?
Well, I think that's the end of the relationship because she does get a restraining order on him. There's a report that he showed up at her house with a sword. And she's like, "You know what? I think this is enough."
Yeah,
and
bad.
She gets a restraining order against him. And she's really freaked out. And this, again, is 1995 that she's mm-hmm. in this relationship with this guy. Or 1995, I think, through I don't know the timeline of it necessarily, but I know the relationship starts in 1995. And I do think that this relationship does continue throughout the period of time that he is also acting as the Simi Valley rapist.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what was wild to find out was, so Vincent has a half brother who was in the Marines, who was like trying to mediate the situation between Vincent and his girlfriend. And what happened was, is after this restraining order was out against Vincent, his brother was checking in on him, and apparently he found a suicide note from Vincent, and he helped get him admitted into the hospital for depression for 18 days. And then his half-brother helped arrange a meeting between this woman and his brother so they could settle their differences. Now, this is uncomfortable because you have a man who has brought a sword to this woman's home, and his half-brother is like, hey, I think you guys just need to talk.
Sounds like you guys aren't listening to each other.
It sounds like you guys are, like, you're hearing each other,
but
you're not
listening.
Could you
sheath that sword?
Put the sword away.
And unsheath your ears.
Again, this is what's really fucked up, too. His brother then, while this couple is talking, he leaves them alone. Again, not a great idea. And his brother goes to Vincent's car. And in his car, he finds a black ski mask, gloves, handcuffs, ammo, and a bag full of female garments. He then goes to his brother and he's like, what the fuck is this? Is it like, do you have a gun? And Vincent's like, okay, all right, here. And he takes him to a dumpster where he stashed a shotgun. And his brother's like, this is probably related to the threats against your girlfriend. And he doesn't question why he has any of those items. And he just lets him go.
Yes, he does. But that's what his story is. But like, what is he? All that and was not like, so you're a killer. He saw that and then was like,
you seem like you're going
through anything. You're my brother.
Well, he fucking, and he tells a newspaper this. So like, this is written down in a report somewhere, which is also really fucking shocking.
Right. And so, because he didn't go to the police that night. So you have to have a story of why you didn't. So you have to be like, it never would have occurred to me. When I saw that, it never would have occurred to me that he was hurting people. I just thought, weird guy.
He loved skiing in Southern California. That's what I thought.
In women's garments.
And he loved women's garments. And jewelry. Why not?
He's a collector.
Well, he is a collector of trophies.
Right.
So when the relationship finally does end between him and his girlfriend, years, I think this process was not overnight. I think this took years. He told his neighbor how he contemplated suicide, and he started crying to this neighbor. And he said, you know, he almost killed himself and that he needed to get off the streets because he needed to go to jail. He said, he's done stuff that you wouldn't believe. And if I found out, I would call the police on him. There seems like a lot of fucking signs that this guy was bad news, but nobody is doing anything.
For sure.
So on July 4th, he's at a 4th of July party, and his neighbors were called drinking with him, and he didn't seem that stressed. But on July 5th, early that morning, his car was gone. They look into the description, so they start looking at, obviously they have the Simi Valley rapist on their hands. They have not yet connected Megan to this criminal. Mm. And they do start to get a little bit of a light bulb moment when they're seeing all of the victims of the Simi Valley rapist, and they're seeing the description of Megan, and they're finding that the two of them are actually, there is a similarity. The MO of his victims is pretty spot on for Megan. And so they start suspecting that he might have something to do with Megan. And then it's on August 4th, a month later, that they find Megan Barroso's body. She was found at the bottom of a 50-foot ravine in Black Canyon, which is just outside of the Simi Valley city limits. She was found in a black t-shirt and underwear with twine around her wrists and her neck. They are not able to determine if she has been sexually assaulted because, as the decomposition had already set in, they're not able to confirm. But now they have to determine if Sanchez was, in fact, the guy. They have to use forensic evidence. So I mentioned that there was bullets at the scene of her car. And when they went through and tested those, they found that they were most likely casings from an AK-47 rifle, and they're able to place an AK-47 rifle into Sanchez's hands because his roommate had it, and his roommate said, hey, you can borrow this gun, no problem. So he was theoretically armed with an AK-47. They also were able to search his property, and they found her green jacket in a trash bin outside with a bullet hole in it. Now, none of this is really, I mean, a lot of this is going to indict him, of course, but they say that the smoking gun of this case is that what really places Megan and Sanchez in the same location is the red glitter that was sprinkled on her by her friend on July 4th.
Oh my God.
They were able to find glitter both on the rifle. They were also able to find the red glitter in Sanchez's truck. And what they did is they had a forensic
glitter. It's like glitter is such a fucking nuisance. You can never get rid of that
stuff.
It's nice to hear a story where you're like, thank God.
Exactly.
Cover me in glitter when I'm in danger.
I've heard it said that glitter is
people
the STD
often.
Of theaters.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. And so once you get it, you can't get rid of it. It's just like that's funny. It's a part of it. So some theaters will actually say, please do not bring glitter. That being said, her friend Lindsay had the bottle of glitter that she had used, and they were able to take a look, and they saw it was a hexagonal glitter with approximately 250 microns in diameter, and they were able to match these glitters to one another to definitively prove that it was the same glitter on Megan's body as the glitter that was found in Vincent Sanchez's truck, which allows them to really connect the two together. He was charged with first-degree murder and possible rape of Megan Barroso. He was also charged in 14 other cases related to the Simi Valley rapist. His trial begins in 2003. He admits to killing Megan, but he does not admit to assaulting her. The lawyers stated that they could not prove that he raped her, so he shouldn't be charged with first-degree murder. It is believed he killed Megan because she not only saw his face, but she also saw his car, and she could give a description of his truck. And so they say that it came down to this poor girl was at the wrong place at the wrong time. The jury does not care what the defense attorney says. They find him guilty, and they recommend pursuing the death penalty. The judge agrees and imposes death by lethal injection and multiple life sentences for the other violent rapes. One of the victims stated in court, "I hope you don't take it easy on him because he didn't take it easy on us." The survivors of these crimes are strong women who were able to face him in court, and I hope they get peace, and I hope they have some closure. And for those who loved Megan, she was kind, she was well-liked, she didn't have any enemies, and she will be missed. And that's a story of how glitter helped put away a serial rapist.
Wow. This interesting that you covered this case this week. My case is in a neighborhood adjacent, both in timeline and in theme. My case I got from the Independent, People magazine, Wikipedia, The Cut, BBC, and Slate. I'm going to start with a story about a young woman named Rowan, and this was from People. She met Rondi Alcala when she was 13 years old in 1965. She was in a parking lot of a teenage nightclub, which I've never heard of a teenage nightclub.
No.
They just don't serve alcohol or what?
Yes, I think they're like 18, they're like 16 plus, no alcohol. There was a place in my hometown called Zero Gravity that they always had ads for, and I never went. And I heard stories that there was like bubble night, but I think what it is, unfortunately, is I think it's just a place for creepy old men to pick up young women.
Okay.
Like, I don't, it's not as like, it doesn't seem like as innocent is
so
what I
he
think.
He was born in 43, and we're talking about 65. That makes him 22, and she's 13. What happens is they meet, and she's, I think, doing a 13-year-old flirty, maybe, which means she scratches his arm, and he tells her to stop, and she doesn't. So he grabs her and drags her into the alley behind the club and slams her head into a wall. She passes out, and when she wakes up, he has pushed an industrial dumpster up against her, like crushing her against the wall. So she starts crying for help, and the people that work there come out and help her, and she doesn't see him till 3 years later. So bad feelings about this guy, but also 13 years old and no context and doesn't tell anyone about it. And then 3 years later sees him, and it's on the Sunset Strip, and she's with a bunch of people, and somehow this group ends up hanging out together. She ends up in a car with him behind the wheel. And takes her and a bunch of her friends. They're going to go, I think, to IHOP or something. But he's like, let's stop at my house. And he gives everybody weed, and people are smoking weed. And he grabs her and pulls her into the bedroom. And he takes off his belt and locks the door. And she's like, what's going to happen to me? And he punches her in the face and uses a knife to cut off her clothing and puts his belt in her mouth. And he ties her up and beats her up and breaks her ribs and rapes her. And she's 16 years old.
Oh, my God.
Her friends are out in the living room or wherever smoking weed. And they're like, where did she go? And when they realize the door is locked and he won't open it, one of the friends breaks the window to the room. And Rodney's in there with blood on him, just looking at the guy, and says, take her. And just throws this naked young Rowan at her friends. And Rowan says, if my friend hadn't broken that window, I really think I would be dead. She's totally traumatized by this experience and doesn't tell her parents. Probably that feeling of like I would get in trouble somehow,
right,
or having shame around it. Now I just want to tell you a little bit about Rodney Alcala, who was born Rodrigo Jacques Alcala Bucur on August 23rd, 1943. He lived in Mexico, but when he's 8, his family moves to L.A. I read that he moved there when he was 11. I don't think it actually matters. What you should know is that he has a really healthy upbringing from an outside perspective. He is academically gifted. He has friends. His family is kind to him. He goes to private schools in LA, and he's on the yearbook committee, and he runs cross country. And then when he's 17 years old, he graduates and he joins the army. People are right away like, this guy is off. And he keeps getting disciplined for assaulting women, which they don't love. And then in 1964, he has some sort of breakdown or something flips where he goes AWOL and he just wants to be out. And he hitchhikes to North Carolina, he hitchhikes from North Carolina to his house in California, just shows up, and his mom's like, okay, and they take him to the doctor. He gets diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, and they discharge him on medical grounds. After this, he goes to school, and he goes to really good schools. He goes to UCLA School of Arts and Architecture, and then he ends up going to film school in New York. So a talented, smart individual with some personality disordered behaviors, mm-hmm, and maybe a little bit of mania, but that's just because I'm taking a DSM class and I'm wanting to attach things to this. In September of 1968, a guy named Donald Haynes sees Rodney Alcala taking a little girl who's 8 into his car. This little girl, Tali Shapiro, is walking to school, and Rodney drives up to her and is like, do you need a ride? And she's like, no. And then he's like, I know your parents. And so she gets in the car. He then says, I want to take you to my home. I want to show you a picture. And all the while, Donald Haynes saw this little girl get in the car, and his blink goes off right away. He's like, the way this guy's talking to this kid, nope, no. So he follows them. He follows the car. Something's really off. He calls 911 from outside the house. The police arrive. And when Alcala opens the door, he's naked. They push in. They say that he looks like an animal, like rage in his eyes. They push into his home, kick in the door, and they see this little girl lying in a pool of blood with a metal bar next to her neck, and they're like, she's dead. But then they hear her breathing. They take, like, the bar off her neck that's been pinned there, and she's breathing, so they take her to the hospital. Meanwhile, Alcala runs out the back door, gets away.
Coward.
This little girl, this 8-year-old, is in a coma for a month, and then when she comes out of the coma, she's still in the hospital. It's taking a really long time to recover. She's been assaulted. It's horrific. I'm so grateful for Donald Haynes saved this little girl's life, just right. Following his blink and being like, something yeah. is off. Now, in order to not get arrested for this, he beats it out of California, and this is when he goes to film school. He goes to New York and is like, I'm not Rodney Alcala, I'm John Berger, and I'm going to go to film school here. He meets a young woman named Cornelia Crilly, who's a 23-year-old flight attendant. She's moving into a new apartment. He meets her. She wants some help moving furniture. No. She will end up being raped and murdered in this apartment by him, strangled with her own pantyhose. After strangling this woman, he then gets a job at the New Hampshire Arts Camp as a counselor for kids.
No.
He's using a different burger. Like, he, maybe the first burger he used was BR, and this is BUR. And meanwhile, the FBI has added him to their list of 10 most wanted fugitives. Because they added him to the list, there are a couple campers that I guess are looking at that list and are like, that looks like our counselor. So in August, he gets arrested and extradited to California. What has happened is that what they really need to put him away is testimony from Tali Shapiro. Tali Shapiro, after she was assaulted and in this coma, this little girl, the parents took her and moved her to Mexico. They do not let her testify at this trial. She has been traumatized by this. And they're like, absolutely not. Leave her alone. They cannot charge Alcala with attempted murder. He gets instead convicted of child molestation, and he's only sentenced to 3 years, and he's paroled after 34 months. He's released in 1977 as a registered sex offender. Weirdly, even though he's released as a sex offender in L.A., they're like, it's okay if you go to New York. And he does. And a week after he gets there, Ellen Jane Hover, who is a 23-year-old, she's the daughter of a kind of famous nightclub owner, a guy that's really part of the scene. I'm just telling you that because it's sort of interest that her godparents are Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr., not as a couple, but like, she's like,
I mean, I would love
that. It does make it sound like that, though, doesn't it? Like, they were both like holding hands at
the christening.
So when they're looking for this girl that's disappeared, they see in her planner that she had an appointment to meet a man named John Berger on the day that she went missing. And then a friend of hers expands on this and says, oh, yeah, he wanted to take photographs of her. And they were going to meet somewhere near the Hudson and do a photo shoot. And they go to our guy, Rodney Alcala, a.k.a. John Berger, and are like, you know this girl? And he's like, yeah, but I don't know anything. So they can't do much because they don't have a body. But then they do, a year later, find her in a remote location dead by the Hudson River, her body hidden under some rocks. Meanwhile, Rodney has moved back to L.A., and he's really into this photo shoot beat. He's working as a typesetter at a publication, and he's freaking out his coworkers constantly, being like, check out my photos. And a lot of them are of teenagers, boys, girls. A lot of them are naked. And people are like, cool.
John, stop.
They interview him because they think he might be the Hillside Strangler, and he's not. which is so interesting to me as well. Yeah. That's simultaneously happening. They're like, is it you? And it's not him. But he is doing the same exact stuff. It's one of the reasons that Rodney Alcala is particularly famous is that in the midst of a killing spree that he has in the mid to late 70s, he's about 35 years old at the time. And he also has time while he's running around raping and killing people to enter himself as a contestant on The Dating Game.
This guy.
Yes. So this young woman is a drama teacher and she gets picked to be a contestant. She goes on this dating show and one of the contestants is this photographer who, like, oh, what was the tagline? Is so gross. Successful photographer who got his start when his father found him in the dark room at the age of 13. Fully developed. I mean, the show was like a lot of sexual innuendo. And this woman, Bradshaw, is like, tell me what kind of meal you'd be. And he said, I'm called the banana. I look really good. Peel me. Everything in retrospect, twice as upsetting.
Twice
because
as disgusting.
We know
yeah.
who this guy is. Also, one thing that really is not going to sit well with anybody is that public records show that this man beat and raped an 8-year-old. But
they
don't do big, they don't do criminal background checks for these shows.
Fuck. Oh
he's God. On the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives list, and he's like on television in The Dating Game,
talk
and
about,
she picks
like,
him.
Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, God.
But then she calls the contestant coordinator, and she's like, I gotta say, I picked him. I'm not gonna go out with him. I get like kind of weird vibes. Something's off. I wouldn't be comfortable. Is that okay? And they're like, yeah, we don't care if you go on a date. It's for TV. Like, we don't care what happens with your life. Close call. So that dating show happens in 1978. And so I told you he was on a killing spree. I'm going to not go into a ton of detail, but I do want to outline what was happening during those years and who some of his victims are. In October of 1977, he murders a 19-year-old named Pamela Jean Lamson. She is telling her friends that she's headed to Fisherman's Wharf to meet a guy that wants to photograph her, and she'll be found beaten and naked and near a hiking trail in Marin County. November of 77, Jill Terry Barcombe is 18 years old. She's strangled, beaten, and assaulted. In December, a month later, a 27-year-old nurse named Georgia Marie Wickstead is found naked on her bedroom floor, strangled with her pantyhose, and someone had broken into her home, and they mutilated her. June 77, a 28-year-old named Christine Ruth Thornton is last seen hitchhiking and then never seen again until her body is found. She is naked. She's beaten and killed. She is 6 months pregnant at the time. Later, the way they pin that one on him is they find a photograph of her in one of his collections. June of 78, Charlotte Lee Lamb is a 32-year-old legal secretary. She is sexually assaulted, beaten, and strangled with a shoelace. Then, the following year of 79, on Valentine's Day, Monique Hoyt is hitchhiking near Riverside County, and he picks her up. He drives her to his apartment and rapes her, and then he takes her to an area to photograph her after he's raped her. They go to this remote mountain area in Joshua Tree, and he takes pictures of her in her underwear. He takes pictures of himself raping her. He bounds her. He gags her, and he's raping her again, and then he's beating her to a point where she is unconscious because he hits her with a rock. When she comes to, I don't know exactly what she says to him, but she acts like she wants to pursue a relationship. Okay. Basically, if you see, it's a movie right. And it's totally fictionalized, but when they made the movie of this, the girl comes to and she's like, hey, you're not going to tell anybody about this, right? Like, it can be between us, right? Like she kind of acts like we just had really violent, kinky sex. But that's our thing, right? We're not going to talk about it. Like she acts embarrassed, like I'm part of this. This was, I'm complicit in it. It's a you and me thing, right? And that's how it happens in the movie. I don't know how it happened in real life, but something that she tells him makes him think that it's okay to not kill her.
Right.
And they get back in the car together instead of him killing her and hiding her body in Joshua Tree. And they keep going and they go to a gas station to use the bathroom and she runs and she tells somebody. And the police come and I don't know if he's arrested then or if he runs and then they find him. And then but his mom posts bail.
He got bail.
He got bail.
He was offered fucking bail.
He got bail because all he did was beat and rape a young woman that was hitchhiking that, again, was 15.
Oh, my God.
15 years old. Can you imagine having the wherewithal to go through what she
As
went
a
through?
15-year-old, the fear to just
and
pretend,
the fear and the like getting the police and having that feeling of it's over, and then they're like, we're just gonna let him go.
They probably didn't even tell her because at this point, I'm sure they weren't like informing victims of shit. I'm sure they didn't believe her. I'm sure they believed him. Fuck. The amount of times this person was in their grasp, like the amount of times this person, and of course he'd go on a TV dating show. Of course he'd be.
Because what is he learning from this experience except that
he can just get away with it.
Yeah. So after his mother posts bail, his next victim is June Jill Marie Parentu. She's 21 years old. And he also breaks into her house to kill her. And he leaves his blood on the broken window. So that's how they link him to it. And friends say that they hung out a couple times before this murder. And a week after he kills her, he kills 12-year-old Robin Christine Samso. She's biking to her ballet class. And they later find her body. And when her friends are shown a picture of Rodney, they're like, oh, that guy approached us at the beach. He wanted to take pictures of us.
It's so crazy that he had different MOs. Some of it was opportunity. Some of it was premeditated. Like there's.
Sometimes he knew you a couple times. Mm-hmm. Sometimes. Yeah. It's very unclear. It's like, hey, can you help me move this couch? Yep. And you're his next victim. He has his eye on somebody and he just chooses them and they're his next victim. It's so random. He gets arrested in 1979 for the rape and murder of Robin Samso. Then they collect his DNA and it matches all these other murder cases and they start ticking them off. They try to get him diagnosed and that part is, you know, interesting to me, but it's not consistent. He sees a lot of different psychiatric experts and he, among the things that he's clinically diagnosed with are narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, malignant narcissism with psychopathy, sexual sadism, all kinds of things. But one thing that's really alarming, having heard about all these women that were strangled, is that they have reason to believe that he, like an animal, played with them like they were toys, tried to strangle them so they wouldn't totally die, so that they would pass out, come to, and he could do it again. He is found guilty in May of 1980 and sentenced to death in June. But then, this is kind of crazy, follow me on this journey. They overturn it, the California Supreme Court does in 84, because jurors weren't told about some of his sex crimes, which would not have impacted any of this, by the way. So then in 86, after a second trial that is the same as the first trial, except that they're like, oh, and here's this other testimony.
He's also a serial rapist.
Oh, yeah. He's worse than you thought. Does that change anything? And they're like, yeah, no. So then he's convicted again, sentenced to death again in that year. In 1992, they upheld the verdict, but he files a federal habeas corpus petition. And in 2001, a U.S. district court is like, yep. So that overturns the second conviction. In 2003, it's upheld by a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and they uphold that because they're like, well, the problem is that a witness was not allowed, you're going to die, to support Rodney Alcala saying that a park ranger that found the 12-year-old's body had been hypnotized by police investigators. And because the witness wasn't allowed to say that, that's a problem. So, in all this time that this is happening, that it's overturned and underturned and flip-flopped, they're sprucing up their case, right? So they're attaching him to more and more rapes and murders while this is happening. Also, while this is happening, he writes and self-publishes a book called You, the Jury, where he says he's innocent and, like, it's very conspiracy theory driven and that there's somebody else that did this. He also is filing lawsuits. I mean, the guy needs a hobby. Slip and fall incidents that he's, like, filing lawsuits on. He says that the prison refused to provide him with the diet that he wanted, which was a low-fat diet. So, like, anything he can do to make everybody's life a living hell, he'll do it. So then the third trial happens. It has been 31 years since he picked up that 15-year-old and she got away from him, Monique Hoyt. Mm-hmm. And she's so freaked out 31 years later to be anywhere near him that an LAPD detective sits with her and she tells everybody in the courtroom, this man ruined my life. Rodney, I'm sure this will come as no surprise, is like, I'm gonna be my own lawyer. In the process of being his own lawyer, he basically does really intense role playing where for 5 hours, he's being the interrogator and the witness, and he asks himself questions saying, Mr. Alcala, in a deep voice. Like, he does a role.
He's
like,
voice.
Mr. Alcala, is it true you were there? And then he'll answer them as himself. So he's like doing a puppet show. As part of his closing.
I don't want tickets to that. I don't want to go see that puppet show.
You
want to
hear his closing number?
A number? Yeah. Does he
his
do a
closing
dance?
Number is that he plays Alice's Restaurant by Arlo Guthrie. Maybe because there's a part of the song where somebody's telling their psychiatrist they want to kill. I'm not really sure why he plays that song, but that is his decision in his closing argument.
That's his closing argument.
So okay. You can imagine that he was sentenced to death a third time. They were like, get out of here. So 2010, sentenced to death at last. Many years in the making. One thing that really struck me is that when this is happening in 2010, it's on the news, and Rowan, who was 13, then 16, sees it, and she is so overwhelmed because what had happened is that at some point somebody had sent her an article about him, and she had felt like that little girl, Tali Shapiro, it was her fault. Because she was like, that guy raped me. I got away. I didn't tell my parents. Then I found out that he raped this 8-year-old girl.
Yeah.
I could have done something about it. And she was carrying so much guilt. So she doesn't know what to do. All these big feelings are coming up. She writes to Tali Shapiro on Facebook and basically sends her this apology. And then Tali writes back and is like, whoa, 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 you don't have anything to apologize for. None of this is your fault. And it changes everything for her. Like, it's the most therapeutic thing in the world for Rowan to be, like, forgiven. And it is a big part of her recovering from her trauma. And they become close. And they start seeing each other all the time and providing strength for each other and have this really tight friendship bond. Mm-hmm. In March of 2010, they release 120 of Rodney Alcala's photographs because they're to the public. They're like, do you know any of these women? We think we could solve some cold cases if we can figure out who some of these people are, because we have a lot of, if you really look, tightly at the timeline I gave you when I talked about his killing spree, there's a lot of holes in it. And then there's a lot of times where it's like he killed and 1 month later he killed again. And it just doesn't feel like it'd be, I'm going to wait a month and kill, and then I'm going to wait a year and kill. It definitely has. And if he's picking up hitchhikers and things, it could be people that are less likely for someone to know that they're missing. So they try to release all these photographs. So 900 photos are too upsetting to release, I guess, or too pornographic to release to the public. They're too explicit, but 120 they do. And in the first few weeks they make them public, 21 women come forward to identify themselves. And some people are like, I know my loved one is one of these people. They disappeared. We've never seen them again. Like six families, I think, came forward to say that. So there's all these things that come from that. And you can still view the photos and see if you know, because we don't know anymore. He died in 2021 at 77 of a heart attack. And even though they've definitely were able to determine he killed nine people, it definitely, they say that it could be as high as 130. And if you guys haven't, Woman of the Hour was based on this series of events, the Anna Kendrick movie. And I thought it was a really good movie.
And she plays the dating game contestant, doesn't
she? Yeah. Yeah. And it's not like, it's not a documentary, but it is really interesting. Like, it is a really interesting theoretical exploration.
Oh my God. It's just the, like, he was, they were, they could have caught him so many times. So many fucking times.
Mm-hmm.
He went on TV.
I think the most upsetting is definitely Monique Hoyt and what she went through and getting away from him and then being like, I mean, as well as Tali Shapiro, of course,
all
but
of them. Yeah.
It's I mean, these people that, against all odds, survived, and then to watch him get to go do it again and again and again and again.
I think it's like you feel for those, because they got out and he should have been put away, and you also hear their firsthand account, you know, and I think that that also is super impactful, because the people that we won't hear, the over 100 victims, we won't hear their firsthand account and what he did.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting case, because I don't know, like, the diagnosis stuff is interesting to me, but also just the behavior and the personality. Like, he's the only other case I read where I was like, this is like another Ted Bundy, exactly.
Right.
Somebody that has this compulsion and is doing this. And if you met them, some people's blink would go off, but by a lot of accounts, he's charming.
Right.
And a handsome guy that, I mean, there's a reason why he can get a lot of women to go with him and have their picture taken and be alone with him. And it did just remind me, The Stranger Beside Me is so good and such a crazy book written by Anne Rule about Ted Bundy. And so many moments of reading this, I was brought back to that and was like, that is so scary and such a mystery. What is happening with this person's brain chemistry that they are doing this to people and able to live somewhat of a double life?
Jesus Christ.
And have had like a good upbringing, like a kind, no one abused them.
Yeah. Fuck. I mean, I do think that, like, a lot of, we see there's evidence to support that serial rapists will become serial killers, because as soon as they get caught the first time, they can't get, it becomes out of need,
mm-hmm.
out of necessity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you see that in this woman who was able to escape by saying she, you know, ugh, fuck. I hate
that. And there's so many accounts of people in this that were like, when he was in the midst of and would get caught, either by the person that he was committing the act toward or by the police or by, everybody cites how animalistic, like something, like
that something triggered,
something transformed, and he seemed like an animal, like the amount of rage was like palpable.
Right.
Ugh. nightmares.
Well, I hate it. I hate both stories. I hate them.
I do too.
But I will say I'm glad that in both justice was eventually had.
Mm-hmm.
Not fast enough, and it should have happened earlier. In both cases, you see that there was a way to get them earlier and they didn't, which is really frustrating to see if somebody spoke up, if somebody did something. Well, I feel ill.
It's very intense because also the owners of the dog across the street left for the day. So while I'm telling this story, you can't totally hear it, but there's a dog just weeping like uncontrollably, like howling and weeping. And it's quite the back, it's quite the background track to the story.
Whoa, this is not heavy. I don't need this. I don't need the sound design. I'm not interested. Well, dear listeners, dear readers, we'll let you go for now, and we'll see you next week. Did that sound threatening?
Did you mean it to be?
I didn't mean it to be, but it did. But I was like, we'll let you go for now, especially after that story. I was so like, intense. That feels really intense.
But like Rodney Alcala, we'll be back. not great.
Not a good look. Okay, goodbye.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.